was 2003, and Mike had just completed his first 18 months as manager of the chemical analysis business unit in Agilent Technologies, a 12,000-person large high-tech company at the time. Mike's business developed and sold instrumentation devices used in a variety of markets, including food safety, where the instruments perform sophisticated chemical tests to monitor levels of contaminants in food. The opportunity or collaboration problem that had sprung up involved a product idea called the LC Triple Quad, an instrument that analyzed chemical liquids. Mike's salespeople had discovered strong customer demand for this product among food testing labs. Yet much to their frustration, Agilent had nothing to offer them. As Mike told me in my interviews for our study, one of his marketing people had taken to knocking on his office door every week, sticking his head in and asking, "When are we developing a triple quad?" The problem was, Mike couldn't develop an LC triple quad product in his own business unit. While he oversaw the sales force covering the food industry, another business unit, the life sciences team, controlled the technology underlying an LC triple quad. A proposed LC triple quad offering was thus caught between two silos, each with its own customers, technology, and profit and loss responsibilities. To get an LC triple quad to market, Mike would have to work with his peer, Carl, and his team over in life sciences. While Mike was the manager of his own unit, he had no formal authority over Carl and life sciences. He thus had to find ways to engage them in voluntary collaboration, just as everyone else, senior or junior, has to do when working across organizational boundaries. Unfortunately, Carl and his life sciences team didn't want to develop an LC triple quad for good reason. It was perceived as an older technology. As they saw it, the opportunity to sell it into their own market, life sciences companies like pharmaceutical and biotech, had already passed. They didn't know that the LC triple quad could gain traction in other markets, such as food testing, as they weren't involved with those customers. From their perspective, marketing the technology was a potentially costly endeavor with no real upside. To secure the life sciences team's participation, Mike set about creating a compelling business case for the LC triple quad. He drew on members of the sales team to compile data on specific food safety customers. If the numbers weren't there, Mike was prepared to drop the idea. Why pursue a project that wouldn't produce financial results? It turned out the numbers were there, big time. Mike projected that the LC triple quad could earn Agilent more than $150 million in sales within 3 years. The market was even larger if they also marketed LC triple quad in other markets, such as environmental and forensics. Also, if they took into account the expanding China market, the potential market approached $1 billion in 8 years. With these numbers in hand, Mike approached the life sciences people to solicit their participation. "Before you write off the idea," he said, "please listen to my case. Yes, the LC triple quad is mature in life sciences, but you're missing a big point. These other markets are going through a huge growth as they adopt this technology." Mike showed the life sciences team his numbers. "We have solid market information behind this business case," he argued. He also showed how Agilent could use its intellectual property and technological know-how, coupled with strong existing customer relationships, to win against the competition. The Agilent field team knew the customers and understood their needs. All that was missing was the product. Mike had succeeded in getting the life sciences team interested, if not entirely bought in, by dangling a huge carrot, a new $1 billion market they hadn't considered. Adopting an approach that we describe in Chapter 6 about forceful champions, he evoked positive emotions in addition to presenting a rational argument. He got them excited about winning in this market. Mike undertook the first fundamental step in disciplined collaboration, building a clear, rigorous business case. Not every collaboration is beneficial. In determining which to choose, managers and employees should focus on one criterion: value. What's the compelling benefit of getting together and collaborating on a product, service, project, or cost-cutting exercise? How will the collaboration impact revenues, costs, efficiency, customer satisfaction, or quality of service? In Chapter 3, I argued that individuals should assess the value they're creating in the course of redesigning their work. That same logic prevails here. If you can't express the value that a proposed collaboration will bring in a clear, compelling way, then do what Agilent's Life Sciences Unit initially did. Say no. During my years studying collaboration in companies, I've found that few people instinctively build business cases for potential collaborations. That's unfortunate. Our study confirmed the strong relationship between selective collaboration and performance. As our data showed, the best performers sought information and expertise from different places in the company, yet they also resisted collaborating if there was no clear value. In our 5,000-person dataset, both men and women did equally well at following this principle, with 17% receiving a top score on the item, declines requests to collaborate on issues or goals that have unclear value to the company. Brenda, a 39-year-old saleswoman in a retail store in a telecommunication company, used to contact some of the other 7 stores in her Southwest region to obtain sales advice about new products her company was launching. Over time, Brenda realized that such consultations often weren't worth the trouble. So she came to say no more often when a member of her team suggested reaching out to the other sites. Brenda scored a top mark on the aforementioned statement. Yet she didn't isolate herself from her colleagues. She also scored a top mark on the statement, "She actively seeks information and expertise from different places in the company." Brenda had come to discern when to collaborate and when to decline. It was no accident that she ranked among the top 6% of performers in our study. To be disciplined about collaboration is to say no to the wrong opportunities and only select those few that produce compelling value. Calculate the premium. How precisely do you build a business case, a compelling reason, for a proposed collaboration? The following equation from my research and consulting provides a useful guide. Collaboration premium equals benefit of initiative minus opportunity costs minus collaboration costs. Calculate as best you can the premium you would gain from working across teams or departmental boundaries. Be sure to consider both the benefits and the costs of collaborating. If the premium is positive, then collaboration is a go. If the premium is negative, it's a no. For the people in Agilent's Life Sciences Unit, the LC triple quad collaboration wasn't attractive at the outset. By expanding the opportunity to include food and other markets, it became a $150 million opportunity. That's the benefit of initiative in the equation. The life sciences team should have jumped on it right away, right? But they didn't. They were skeptical. Why? As the life sciences team saw it, they had already decided to invest in another technology program, proteomics. They didn't have the money to pursue proteomics and the LC triple quad at the same time. They faced opportunity costs, which are the answer to the question, what benefits do you forego if you do the collaboration project? In life sciences' view, proteomics was a promising program they had to forego or postpone if they did the LC triple quad. The opportunity costs were too high for them to jump on the triple quad. At first, Mike wasn't sure how to respond. If Agilent waited a few years to bring the LC triple quad to market, it would be too late. The company's competitors would have jumped on the opportunity. Somehow, Mike had to lower the opportunity costs for life sciences. Otherwise, they wouldn't sign on. Mike examined his budget and hit upon a solution. The life sciences team could pursue both projects at the same time, provided that he transfers some additional investment money from his unit to theirs. With those funds, Mike could eliminate the most severe opportunity costs, leaving the life sciences team with no excuse. But Mike wasn't done. another problem presented itself. Collaboration costs. Mike had to determine whether people from his unit and life sciences would dedicate themselves to the project. What if some engineers from life sciences preferred to work on proteomics? Would they put in lackluster efforts on the LC triple quad? And how committed were their managers? What if they assigned their engineers only half-time to the project and started to dispute goals and plans? As I wrote in my book, Collaboration, collaboration costs refer to the hassles of working across units, including time spent haggling with the other parties over objectives, efforts to solve conflicts, and all the poor results that these complications create: delays, budget overruns, poor quality, and lost sales. As we shall see, Mike took steps to minimize these potential collaboration costs. In all, he had created a favorable collaboration premium by estimating a $150 million benefit in 3 years, lowering the opportunity costs, and reducing collaboration costs. The first rule of disciplined collaboration: establish a compelling why do it case for every proposed collaboration. If it's not compelling, don't do it and say no. Evaluating collaboration opportunities, large and small. Mike's situation might seem different from the kinds of collaborations you typically consider in your job. He was proposing a significant business initiative, one that would involve dozens of people and millions of dollars in investment, and one that would potentially yield a business worth hundreds of millions of dollars. What about collaborations that are simpler and smaller, and where the stakes are lower? Is it still desirable and practical to calculate a collaboration premium in these situations? Absolutely. You may not be able to assign numbers, but you can still use this logic and do a 10-minute calculation to evaluate whether you should collaborate or not. Let's go back to Centra Consulting. Jack Mason, who held a plum job as a management consultant in the firm's Atlanta office, was part of a 4-person team preparing a sales bid for a $6 million contract to help Coca-Cola implement a smaller part of its SAP information technology system. Centra's senior partner in charge of the bid had gathered Mason and 2 consultants in his office and told them that, as a team, the 4 of them had sound expertise to make the proposal stellar. Mason put in a lot of effort to make the bid a success. Knowing that other consultants throughout Centra's offices had vast experience with SAP, he thought that tapping into their expertise would help him craft a first-rate sales presentation. He emailed 9 colleagues listed as experts on the relevant topic. 3 colleagues from the San Francisco, New York, and Dallas offices, respectively, agreed to fly in to Atlanta to meet in person. Mason was pleased with their willingness to collaborate in the new silo-flattened culture. It looked as if his team would deliver a terrific sales bid as a result. Unfortunately, the project soon veered off course. The 3 experts knew their SAP all right, and they showed up with the swagger to prove it. During the following 3 weeks, they offered diverging views on how best to position the Coca-Cola sales bid. The London fellow urged the team to pursue a low-cost bid. The San Francisco techie pressed the team to play up the innovation angle. The New York expert insisted on including extra services. The debate heated up. Mason's 2 team members in the Atlanta office grumbled that between them, they already had the knowledge they needed to draft the bid. Why did they have to spend valuable time listening to these outside experts? "Too many cooks in the kitchen," one of them complained. Distracted by the conflicting advice and volumes of input, the team struggled to develop a coherent plan in time for the deadline. In the end, the partner described the final proposal as a mishmash of several approaches. No surprise, they lost the bid. Let's analyze this case using the collaboration premium equation. What did the Atlanta team stand to gain by soliciting help from the 3 experts in San Francisco, London, and New York? Not very much. The Atlanta team already possessed significant expertise, so it wouldn't benefit much from getting additional insight. What were the opportunity costs? Large. The team could have spent its limited time working on the proposal instead of interacting with the three experts. What were the collaboration costs? Huge. By insisting on different approaches, the experts created conflict. All in all, the outcome was surely a negative collaboration premium. Had Mason paused and spent 10 minutes thinking through this logic, he wouldn't have contacted those outside colleagues. There wasn't a compelling business case for it. If a collaboration premium seems to be negative, don't hesitate to say no. It doesn't matter if others in your company hold the potential collaborators in high regard, or if you like them personally, or if your boss supports your company's collaboration initiative, or if the collaboration's benefits seem attractive at first glance. Buck the pressure. Refuse to engage. On the other hand, if a compelling case exists, don't just proceed in a casual, thoughtless way. Go all in. Make the most of the few collaborations you do undertake. Let's examine how. Get them excited. Why might people prove unwilling to collaborate with you? One major reason is the lack of a unifying goal. Consider an example from the global professional services company DNV. A group of 6 people from 2 business units formed a collaboration project inside the firm to exploit a nice opportunity. The first business unit delivered consulting services to food companies, helping them lower food risks like E. coli bacteria in their supply chain. The second business unit issued certifications to food companies that verified their supply chain's cleanliness. The consulting and certification units had operated as completely independent entities, each serving different customers in the food industry. In this collaboration project, they sought to approach their customers jointly to cross-sell services. They would sell certification to consulting clients and consulting to the certification customers. The business case they generated projected a whopping 50% growth in combined revenues so long as the team executed their plan. 2 years later, the collaboration project had failed. Why? One major reason was the lack of a unifying goal. As team members started executing, the consultants had one goal: maximize consulting revenues. Likewise, the certification people had their own goal: maximize certification revenues. As a result, neither group exerted much effort helping the other land new contracts. What could the project managers have done differently? They could have articulated a compelling, unifying goal, such as grow combined market share in food by 50% in 3 years. That's a common goal that could excite each sales force to work toward winning in the marketplace together. Mike at Agilent articulated such a unifying goal for the LC Triple Quad product: grow revenues from $0 to $150 million in 3 years. As you heard, the life sciences team had initially rejected Mike's idea, thinking only about the limited revenue opportunity for the LC Triple Quad represented within their own life sciences customers. Mike's compelling goal considered the total market, not just the small life sciences piece. That more comprehensive goal helped unify the interests of the two business units. Such unifying goals are powerful because they ask people to subordinate their individual interests to the common good. In Chapter 7, Fight and Unite, I also emphasized the importance of having a team goal to unify team members. These goals are even more important for collaborative projects because they span units with potentially conflicting objectives. In our study, we scored people on this statement: when he or she collaborates with others, he or she always makes sure that they have a common goal and are not just pursuing individual agendas. More women in our sample scored higher on this question than men. Almost half of women, 47%, set common goals, as opposed to just 39% of men. Second rule of disciplined collaboration: craft a unifying goal that excites people so much that they subordinate their own selfish agendas. You may throw up your hands and say, "Wait, I am not the top boss, and I am low in the hierarchy. I can't craft a goal for someone else in a different department." I often hear this objection, but consider Mike's situation at Agilent. He was not the big boss overseeing both the chemical and the life sciences businesses. He had to convince his counterparts, his peers, in another business unit. They could have said no, and initially they did. Collaboration means working with people over whom you have no formal authority. To motivate and excite them, you can do what Mike did and articulate a compelling, unifying goal. We saw how forceful champions employed a similar tactic in Chapter 6. The goal is to excite people, to evoke their emotions, so that they prioritize the goal of the collaboration over their own departmental agenda. But beware, not all unifying goals will help. Based on my 2 decades of studying and advising on unifying goals, I have identified 4 qualities that can guide you to make them effective. Try to make them common, concrete, measurable, and finite. The most famous and successful unifying goal of all time might well be President Kennedy's dream, articulated in a 1961 speech, "Before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to Earth." Now that's a common goal. All 400,000 people working on the project, those working on the rockets, the landing vehicle, the spacesuits, and so on, had to collaborate to accomplish it. The goal was simple and concrete: a man on the moon. It was measurable. The mission was over when the men returned safely to Earth. It was finite: within a decade. Contrast Kennedy's moon goal with the goal that then NASA Administrator James Webb wanted: preeminence in space, including satellites, science, rockets, a moon landing, and so on. That sounds like many company goals, such as becoming the best investment bank or the premier retailer. Webb's formulation violated all 4 of my criteria. It wasn't a common goal, bringing together satellite engineers and scientists, for example. It was vague. You needed another page of text to explain it. It was impossible to measure. When have you reached preeminence? Finally, it specified no deadline. Someday? The key to incorporating these 4 qualities is to concretize what is vague. Don't say, "Our objective is to fight malaria in the world." Say, "We want 0 deaths from malaria in 20 years. And then track the number of deaths by country. Don't say, "To become the leading provider of IT solutions for companies in Dallas." Say, "Number 1 by market share in Dallas in 3 years. Don't say, "Grow revenues of LC Triple Quad." Say, 0 to 150 million in 3 years. Reward. Yes, but what? The folks at DNV encountered another problem. Their performance incentives didn't align with the collaboration project. The certifiers were rewarded financially based on how well the certification business performed. The consultants, based on their unit's performance. Steve Kerr, General Electric's former chief learning officer, summed up this problem in an article with a great title: "On the Folly of Rewarding A While Hoping for B." Rewarding individual work, hoping for collaboration. It doesn't work. At Agilent, salespeople in the field loved the LC Triple Quad product. Their customers in food, environmental, forensics, and in China craved it, and the salespeople would reap big rewards for selling it, as it would become part of their sales quota. But what about salespeople in the life sciences unit? Sales to pharmaceutical and biotech customers would be tiny, so why should they develop this product if they weren't rewarded for it? Mike had thought of that problem, and he had a solution. He decided that all revenues from the LC Triple Quad would roll up to the profit account for the life sciences unit. He wasn't interested in receiving a portion of the profits for his business unit. Life sciences would get the credit even when the product was sold into food. They thus had huge incentives to develop this product, and indeed, when they saw how big the number was, they became very motivated. When I discussed this case with Mike, I asked him, "It sounds like everyone was incentivized except you." To which he answered with a chuckle, "It wasn't completely altruistic on my part." Yes, Mike was first and foremost thinking about what was best for Agilent, but he also had another motive for developing the LC Triple Quad product. His business unit eventually wanted to develop other products that hinged on the development of the LC Triple Quad. In Mike's mind, the LC Triple Quad fed into a longer-term strategy. In addition, Mike's boss had informed him in the previous performance review that he was doing a terrific job as a general manager, but that he wasn't thinking broadly enough. "You're really in your silo," his boss said. "And that often happens with new general managers, and I really want you to think more broadly across the company." Advancing LC Triple Quad was a way that Mike could help improve results across the company. The incentives for all three parties, the salespeople in the field, the folks at Life Sciences, and Mike's team, all lined up. They reinforced the unifying goal. Whenever you can, tinker with the rewards setup so that you can motivate people to channel their effort in pursuit of the unifying goal. In our study, slightly more women excelled at aligning incentives, with 34% scoring high on "she or he always makes sure that the people she or he collaborates with across the company have a great motivation to help out." Only 29% of men scored high on this item. As I expected, the men and women who scored high on this item performed better. Be careful about how exactly you frame incentives. I often see people trying to reward collaboration activities, not results. Many managers note whether people participate in collaborative activities such as task forces, committees, and joint visits to customer sites. And so people check the box, "Yes, did show up for that committee meeting." When you reward activities, that's what you get. Lots of collaboration activities. This leads to over-collaboration and people working long hours and evenings. Activities are just that, activities, and not accomplishments. What counts is results. The third rule of disciplined collaboration: reward people for collaboration results, not activities. Go all in. Tammy, a 42-year-old maintenance supervisor at a California-based trucking company, told us in an interview that when her department creates a budget, it first funds departmental priorities and only then considers cross-company initiatives in need of staffing. At that point, we have already allocated most of our money and the best people. As a result, the department had neglected important collaboration projects, like a joint effort with the human resources and logistics departments to better maintain the trucks. Key people on the collaboration project were part-time, and money was tight. The project floundered. People often pack their schedule with work they must do for their own department, reserving their remaining time, their night shift, so to speak, for collaborative projects. According to one employee in our study, finding time is the key problem. Helping someone in another department is always a lower priority than working on your own department's priorities. The result is that people spend too little time honoring their collaboration commitments. To maximize your collaboration's chances of success, you need a forcing mechanism to assure that your collaboration receives sufficient time, effort, and financial support. Mike, at Agilent, wondered whether his life sciences partners would go all in on the LC Triple Quad. With proteomics beckoning, their best people might have dedicated themselves 100% to that other project. If they had, the B team would have drifted over to LC Triple Quad, perhaps only working part-time on it. To lower this risk, Mike made sure that the life sciences unit established two separate teams, one for proteomics and the other for the LC Triple Quad. As Mike recalled, "I moved some people into the Triple Quad team full-time. I put my best marketing guy, you know, the guy that was sticking his head into my office all the time asking when we were getting the triple, I said, 'Guess what? This is your new job now.'" On the life sciences side, Mike reviewed and approved the proposed staffing. I asked for their names. I knew them all well, and I chose who I wanted on this team. He also made sure that the staff assigned to the project all had 100% of their time allocated to it. "We have a saying in Agilent," he told me, "part-time people, part-time results." Mike also made sure that the triple quad team had the money it needed. Remember, he had transferred some of his own budget to fund it 100%. Mike had created what I call a collaboration time budget, which includes three items. Time, how many full-time people or equivalents are on the project. Skills, whether the people have the requisite skills. And money, the dollar amount allocated to the project. Disciplined collaboration requires that participants make the necessary time commitments up front. If you can't obtain full resources, reduce the scope of the project, extend the schedule, or kill the project. I've found in my research and consulting that under-resourced collaboration projects are often doomed. Fourth rule of disciplined collaboration: devote full resources, time, skills, money, to a collaboration. If you can't, scale it back or scrap it. Engineer trust fast. When we collaborate, we sometimes work with strangers and people we don't know well, in part because we gather people from departments and geographies that are separated from one another. That means that there is a deficit of trust. We haven't had a chance to build trust with strangers, and we haven't yet formed strong relationships with mere acquaintances. We might even distrust partners if our prior collaborations ended poorly. Trust is a key issue in collaboration. We can define trust as people's confidence that colleagues will deliver the high-quality work expected of them on time, every time. In our data set of 5,000 people, almost half, 46%, said there was a lack of trust in their collaboration efforts. That's too bad. Individuals in our study who fostered the most trust with their fellow collaborators performed much better. The correlation between the measure of very good at fostering trust with collaboration partners and performance was a very high 0.70. Slightly more women were better at establishing trust than men, like Anne, who, as a regulatory counsel in a data analysis company based in Watertown, Massachusetts, worked diligently to garner trust in her collaborative efforts. "I work in an office remote from most of the people that I work with," she said. "But we spend a lot of time on the phone, and I travel often to meet with them to build relationships and trust. So I trust the folks that I have to rely on to do their jobs in their areas, and they know they can count on me to come through when they have a tight need and need a quick turnaround." If you don't trust your partners, or if you actively distrust them, what can you do? Given the hurried nature of modern workplaces, you probably don't have much time to work on relationships prior to kicking off your joint work. So are you doomed to a subpar collaboration? Not at all. As our case study suggested, you can engineer trust quickly using a few techniques. The first step is to understand why so little trust exists. Depending on the answer, you might deploy specific trust boosters to improve the relationship. As we've seen, Mike at Agilent feared that some people might not commit. Mike knew that he could count on Carl, the life sciences unit head, once he had committed. The problem was people below Carl. As Mike recalls, "There were people at the project level that really didn't agree with our decision to pursue the LC triple quad." So when he and Carl agreed to go ahead with the LC triple quad, they sent out a joint email spelling out their decision and the commitment they had both made. This public commitment signaled a high level of trust between the leaders. If they could trust each other, so should people further down the organization. Mike also feared that life sciences would put its B team on the project. He lacked confidence in their willingness to staff the project with dedicated, first-rate people. So he verified that life sciences had indeed staffed triple quad with excellent people working 100% on the project. He did the same on his side so that the life sciences partners would gain confidence in his team's skills. Now, both parties could trust that the project was fully resourced. And Mike went one step further. He conducted rigorous quarterly reviews to confirm that the right people were putting in 100% effort and that the project was progressing well according to plan. Fifth rule of disciplined collaboration. If you lack confidence in your partners, tailor trust boosters to solve specific trust problems quickly. Over time, trust between Mike's unit and his colleagues in the life sciences unit took hold, and the project succeeded. 2.5 years after their collaboration began, Agilent introduced the LC triple quad into its designated markets. Within 3 years, the LC triple quad accounted for more than $150 million of annual revenues. Goal reached. How to apply trust boosters. Lack of competence or resources. If you're not certain your partner has the time, money, or skills to deliver high-quality work by the deadline, then verify. For example, ask for track record, prior work. Start small, for example, pilot to test. Insincere intentions. If you're suspicious of your partner's commitment to the unifying goal, then verify. Start small. Get public commitment, for example, Mike's email at Agilent. Misunderstandings. If you and your partner don't agree as to what needs to get done, when, and how, then clarify and educate. For example, Mike at Agilent educating life sciences about the market size. Strangers. If you and your partner don't know one another well and you come from different backgrounds, departments, functions, education, nationality, etc., then bond up front. Team exercise. Share personal information to get to know each other better. As we've seen, Mike's effort with the LC triple quad illustrates all five disciplined collaboration rules. He established a compelling business case and was prepared to ditch it if it wasn't good enough. He set forth a compelling unifying goal of $0 to $150 million in 3 years. He aligned incentives well, especially by assigning all the revenues to the life sciences unit. He made sure the project was fully resourced, money, skills, time. And he used trust boosters to build confidence that collaborators would commit to their shared goal. This disciplined approach to collaboration led to great results for the project, and, I should add, for Mike as well. In 2009, after his boss retired, Mike was promoted to group president. In 2015, he became CEO of Agilent Technologies. That's right. The Mike in this story is none other than Mike McMullen, chief executive of a global business with revenues in excess of $4 billion. The goal of collaboration is not collaboration. At the beginning of this chapter, you heard how physicians and nurses at Fort Dodge Hospital failed to coordinate medical care for Tom Wilson, a chronically ill patient. But that's not the end of the story. In 2012, three leaders at his health system got together. Sue Thompson, President and Chief Executive Officer of Unity Point Health at Fort Dodge, Pam Halverson, Chief Operating Officer of the TriMark Physicians Group, and Deb Shriver, Chief Nursing Officer of Trinity Regional Hospital. They launched a radical change program that galvanized large teams of doctors, nurses, and other caregivers to change their behaviors. While the teams didn't have the disciplined collaboration framework to guide them, they employed the same five rules. Applying the what's the business case logic, rule one, staff members evaluated whether and where collaboration could yield significant cost and patient benefits. One area in particular passed the collaboration premium hurdle. Focus on costly patients like Wilson with multiple chronic diseases. These patients claimed a disproportionate part of the hospital's budget, and they also incurred high readmission expenses. If the healthcare system could attend to these types of patients in a more coordinated way, they could realize substantial savings and improve the quality of care. Teams at TriMark and Trinity then embraced a unifying goal, Rule 2, in launching their effort: reduce readmissions below the penalty level. The government program in which TriMark and Trinity participated penalized high readmission levels. At Fort Dodge, these levels were high. 11.3% of admitted patients had to come back. By taking the penalty level as its goal, TriMark and Trinity required everyone to understand and prevent costly readmissions. In addition, the teams were motivated by a compelling and common incentive, Rule 3: get readmissions down or pay the penalties. Teams at the healthcare organizations committed full resources, Rule 4. Physicians, such as Wilson's primary care doctor, took time to participate in collaboration activities, and the organizations brought on a full-time cross-organization coordinator. To further enhance their collaboration efforts, staff at TriMark and Trinity held weekly meetings to review readmitted patients, inviting nurses, physicians, and specialists, as well as staff from other hospitals, clinics, home care, nursing homes, and mental health centers. These meetings helped strangers to get to know each other, boosting trust. Rule 5. By following the rules of disciplined collaboration, staff at Fort Dodge cut their readmission rate from 11.3% to 8.6%, below the federal demands, in 2 years. Tom Wilson's life changed too. Now he could rely on a personal team of doctors, nurses, and social workers, with team members all working to ensure the quality of his care. A home health nurse visited every week or so to check on him, look at his numbers, and review his daily medications. A more purposeful approach to collaboration allowed the staff at Fort Dodge to cut healthcare costs and improve the quality of care. But it also protected them from the opposite ill: too much coordination. In our zeal to coordinate efforts, we often lose perspective on collaboration's true value and purpose. We think more collaboration is always better, that the key to success is to be ever more wired, networked, coordinated. This belief is wrong. The goal of collaboration isn't collaboration. It's better performance. Disciplined collaboration is the last of our 7 practices that you can adopt to transcend the traditional work harder mindset and work smarter. One of the greatest tragedies of this old mindset is the assumption that we must sacrifice vital parts of ourselves to excel. We put in more hours and take on more tasks, shortchanging family, friends, hobbies, exercise, and sleep. Before long, we wind up burned out, unfulfilled in our personal relationships, and saddled with health issues. A critical question thus emerges: does pursuing the 7 work smart principles and becoming a top performer mean sacrificing your well-being? As our research proves, it does not. But you will need to take some additional steps to achieve what most people only dream about: becoming great at work and at life. The next and final chapter shows you how. Key insights: the 2 sins of collaboration. The work harder convention: the more collaboration, the better. The new work smarter perspective: over-collaboration is as bad as under-collaboration. Busting silos is not the answer. A different tack, disciplined collaboration, helps you collaborate effectively and perform. Key points: organizations and employees struggle with twin sins, under-collaboration and over-collaboration. Some people talk too little across teams and departments, and some people talk too much. To avoid the extremes of too little or too much collaboration, top performers discipline collaboration. They carefully select which collaboration activities to participate in and reject others, and then follow specific rules to make the chosen activities a success. In our study, people who practiced disciplined collaboration placed 14 percentage points higher in the performance ranking than people who didn't. Women benefited more than men. Disciplined collaboration consists of the following 5 rules. 1. Establish the business case, a compelling reason for any proposed collaboration initiative, small or large. If it's questionable, say no. 2. Craft a unifying goal that excites people so that they prioritize this project. 3. Reward people for collaboration results, not activities. 4. Commit full resources, time, skills, and money to the collaboration. If you can't obtain those resources, narrow its scope or kill it. 5. Tailor trust boosters quickly to specific trust problems in the partnership. Part 3. Mastering your work life. 9. Great at work, and at life, too. I began the research described in this book by posing a question. Why do some people perform better at work than others? As our study progressed and the answers to this question came into focus, I began to notice an interesting pattern. Many of the top performers we interviewed, the ones who embraced the practices outlined in this book, realized benefits that extended well beyond their work performance. They were less stressed out, more balanced, and more satisfied with their job. Susan Bishop, the small business owner profiled in Chapter 2, redesigned her executive search business in line with the principle, do less, then obsess. She imposed strict rules about which clients and projects she would accept and what she would reject, and she dedicated herself to the work she took on. As Bishop told us, her life improved dramatically both inside and outside of work. Not only did she perform better, she felt more engaged, satisfied, and energized. Bishop attributed her increased sense of well-being in part to a better work-life balance. Prior to implementing her rules, her work-life balance was, in her words, horrible. With the rules in place, Bishop still worked hard, but she felt as if this huge weight had been lifted. She no longer had to deal with the clients that she hated, as well as the smaller clients whose searches took up so much of her time. Because she and her team weren't bogged down running low-level searches for non-media clients, she could land lucrative assignments, such as a search for an executive position at the Radio City Music Hall Rockettes. Outside of work, Bishop had the energy she needed to steer her family through the sudden death of her daughter's fiancé during the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Years later, she got her Ph.D. and began a second career teaching at a business school. Bishop was hardly alone in seeing improvements in her personal life. Greg Green, the high school principal featured in Chapter 3, told us that his stress level tumbled as his redesign of work took off. Before he flipped the teaching model at Clintondale High School, when his school was placed on a list for potential closure, he was stressed to the max. With a staff of frustrated teachers to manage, he felt uncertain about his future, had trouble sleeping, and endured a range of health issues. After the redesign, as he regained a sense of control over the school, he became more relaxed, and so did his staff. Intrigued by examples like Bishop and Green, I wondered whether a statistical link existed between the 7 practices and improved work-related well-being. The potential implications would be enormous. Top performance in any field seems to demand personal sacrifice. We presume that rising to the top requires crazy hard work, fortitude, endless practice, long hours, that it entails doing without vacations, neglecting your kids or your spouse, and spending weekends and holidays glued to your computer screen. Because we think this way, we tend to let our job responsibilities balloon out of control. Then, to achieve some semblance of a personal life, we go back in and erect a protective shield around our lives to prevent work from crushing them. We switch off the smartphone at home, or refrain from checking email when watching our kids' baseball games, or leave work early on certain days, all to prevent work from burying our private lives. Such measures only serve to treat the symptom, the result of working too much, and not the root cause, the work itself. If the 7 working smart practices contributed to work-related well-being, then work could become part of the solution, not the problem. We could attack the root cause of our diminished private lives by working smarter. We could select very few priorities that maximize value and then apply intense, targeted effort to master the skills required. We could find and select some work activities that match our passion with a sense of purpose in our work. We could carefully choose a few inspirational and influence tactics to convince others to support our efforts. We could participate in fewer teamwork meetings, but foster more intense debates in those meetings we do attend to arrive at better solutions. We could undertake only valuable collaboration efforts and say no to others. Instead of expending so much painful effort trying to rein work in and then complaining when we inevitably fail, we could fix the underlying problem. Work. To test the link between the 7 practices and well-being, we created a well-being measure, querying people in our quantitative study about 3 specific areas related to their jobs: work-life balance, job burnout, and job satisfaction. We ran the numbers and found that proficiency in the 7 practices did indeed correlate with both high performance and an improved sense of work-related well-being. It turns out that the way to achieve both better performance and better well-being isn't to put in more hours and then buttress your personal life with ironclad boundaries. It's to concentrate on working smarter. Work on how you work, not on protecting your life from your work. How much do the 7 practices determine an individual's well-being as defined here? You'll remember from Chapter 1 that the 7 practices accounted for a whopping 66% of the variation we saw in people's performance. Other factors mattered too, such as demographics and the number of hours worked. By comparison, the 7 practices accounted for 29% of the variation in participants' work-related well-being. It makes sense that this effect is not as large as that for performance. Several factors outside of work affect our well-being on the job, including where we live, the length of our commute, the strength of our collegial relationships, our salary, our boss's management styles, our health, and so on. Still, 29% is considerable. The data shows that mastering just 7 practices can substantially improve work-life balance, enthusiasm on the job, and job satisfaction. There is an important caveat, however. Although the 7 practices enhance well-being as I've defined it, a few of them turned out to lower certain parts of well-being. To attain the biggest improvement, you can't just strive to master the 7 practices. You must also employ 3 additional tactics to prevent the negative side effects from occurring. Let's first look at how the 7 work smart practices affect well-being, and then examine those extra tactics you need to become truly great at work. How do you really get better work-life balance? To assess whether the 7 practices help people achieve better work-life balance, I drew on an approach used by Harvard Business School professor Leslie Perlow. We asked participants to score themselves using a scale from 7, completely agree, to 1, completely disagree, on the following statement: the demands of my work interfere with my family and personal time. Because only a participant can answer this of him or herself, we limited our survey to the 2,000 people, out of 5,000 in our study, who assessed themselves. The others were assessed by their bosses or direct reports. When our data came back, we found, not surprisingly, that many people were struggling. Almost a quarter, 24% of our 2,000 participants, completely or strongly agreed that work was interfering with their family and personal time, while a further quarter, 27%, somewhat agreed. About half, 49%, reported that work-life balance didn't trouble them much or at all. Unsurprisingly, many people who worked a lot, between 50 and 65 hours per week on average, reported that work interfered with their personal and family time. At this level, working hours began to eat into evening and weekend time. If you work, say, 50 hours, putting in 9 hours per day and 5 during the weekend, you can just about manage to carve out some good family time. But when you go to 65 hours per week, family time becomes almost impossible. Two practices did improve work-life balance, most notably, do less, then obsess. When you narrow your scope of work and jettison less important tasks, you free up time that you can spend outside work. More disciplined collaboration can also improve work-life balance. People who collaborate stand to benefit from the help they receive, allowing them to work less. Meanwhile, those who discipline their collaboration don't get roped into unnecessary working groups and nighttime conference calls. They minimize the extra time required to collaborate, reducing the chances that work will bog down their private lives. Our analysis also turned up a surprising result. One practice, infusing work with passion and purpose, worsened work-life balance. Many people think of passion at work as exclusively positive, but our study suggests that passion makes it harder for us to sustain boundaries around our work. Kate, a 43-year-old administrative assistant in our study, loved her job at an advertising sales company in Oklahoma City. In our study, she scored high on both passion and purpose. She felt excited to go to work most days because of the learning opportunities her job offered, and she felt that she contributed in important ways by supporting the sales staff with travel, reports, and other paperwork. Her performance placed her in the top 11th percentile of all participants. But she ranked her work-life balance as poor, in part because her excitement for work made her think about it when she was home. Previous studies of employee engagement, a concept similar to passion, have also suggested a link between passion and poor work-life balance. A study of 844 firefighters, hairstylists, educators, caregivers, bankers, and other working adults in the United States revealed that employee engagement, measured by an employee's degree of vigor, dedication, and absorption in work, when I am working, I forget everything else around me, increased work's interference with family life. My work keeps me from my family activities more than I would like. Too much engagement at work led to poor work-life balance. When you feel passionate about your work and engage with your job, you can short other parts of your life. You're so engrossed that you tack an extra hour onto your workday. Before you know it, it's 7 p.m. and you're arriving home too late for your family dinner. Or you end up making your family dinner, but you're distracted and thinking about work. Or you're so focused on specific work tasks that priorities like sleep or exercise lose out. How do you prevent burning out? The Mayo Clinic defines job burnout as a special type of job stress, a state of physical, emotional or mental exhaustion combined with doubts about your competence and the value of your work. Such job stress is quite common in the workplace. We asked the 2,000 self-respondents in our sample to rate their level of work-related burnout. Many experienced some level of mental and emotional exhaustion. About a fifth, 19%, strongly or completely agreed that they felt burned out. Another quarter, 25%, agreed somewhat, with the remaining 56% reporting little or no sense of burnout. Burnout is serious. Research has tied it to ills such as cardiovascular disease, marital dissatisfaction, and depression. Fortunately, our study found that several practices lower the chances of burning out. Do less than obsess can protect people from becoming exhausted at work because it leaves them with fewer priorities to handle and track. Likewise, if you take a more disciplined approach to collaboration, your partnerships enable you to accomplish more in less time, thus preventing exhaustion. Both of these practices prevent you from being physically and mentally exhausted at work. There is another part of burnout, emotional exhaustion. As the Mayo Clinic's definition suggests, burnout can stem from a sense that work is stressful, bristling with interpersonal friction and lacking in meaning. The smart work practices also regulated this emotional aspect of burnout. P squared, matching passion and purpose, helps prevent emotional fatigue. People who experience passion and purpose go to work excited about what they do every day, perpetually reacquainting themselves with work's deep